Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 9th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live deaths from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Pascal Robert, co-host of This Is Revolution, contributing writer at Washington Spectator and HuffPo. Meanwhile, two U.S. citizens held in the wake of the assassination of the Haitian president. The Delta variant rampant amongst the unvaccinated in this country and growing. The U.S. West braces for another deadly heat wave. Meanwhile, the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan is essentially over. Speaking of over, ICE will no longer detain immigrants who are pregnant, postpartum, or nursing. Biden also to issue today a sweeping executive order pushing various anti-monopolist policies. Democrats in deep internal negotiations over the infrastructure bill. Schumer pledges to include civilian climate corps. Pelosi pledges to not include a drop in the Medicare eligibility age. Meanwhile, Texas lawmakers innovate a new way to prohibit women's control over their own bodies and launch a second effort at suppressing the vote in Texas. Lastly, Pepsi boycott launched in support of Kansas Frito-Lay workers who are on strike. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us on this Friday. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, I see that you sort of made a half-hearted attempt to copy what I was wearing today.
I did. You know, if it helps you sleep at night, it was intentional. I just I wanna be you. I wanna be in my 50s and graying and all of those things.
Yeah, I understand. It'll take a little bit of makeup and a little hard living to get here quicker than time would allow. But yes, no, I sleep with actually one eye open. There's a big single white female vibe. Did you know that movie?
Yes, I do. I do know the single white female vibe.
But I do appreciate you did not wear the glasses today.
So yeah, but I mean, I've got
tell us apart.
Yes. I hope the audience understands who's who at this
right.
point. Right.
Well, unfortunately, we do have our names put right in the corner there, so that makes it easier. We got a lot to talk about today, and Pascal will be on to talk about both the what's going on in Haiti, and also he's a Queens native, and I want to get his opinion on the Eric Adams race and also how that ties in to the narrative that that some Democrats are trying to push regarding the radical sloganeering that apparently is taking place that is the reason why moderate Democrats can't seem to win elections properly. We will talk about that. We will talk also about the Delta variant. And this it really astonishing. There's a couple of different dynamics. Pfizer is trying to convince the FDA to approve of a third shot, a booster shot. And the U.S. government is saying, like, we have no data that suggests that it's needed at this point. I think it's quite clear that the vaccines are safe. But the question is, do you really need a third vaccine? Maybe ultimately we might. But and shouldn't we also be focusing on trying to get more people with their first and second shots, particularly in the wake of what's happening with the Delta variant? Really horrific stories coming out of some states, particularly in the Midwest, of doctors in in intensive care units saying they've got a ton of patients who just regret not taking it seriously and thinking it was a joke and thinking that it wasn't real. And the overwhelming, it's almost, I mean, if you're going to speak in generalities, you could basically say, you know, broad generalities, essentially no vaccinated people are dying. You know, in May, the AP looked at the numbers, found 18,000 deaths. 150 of those were the unvaccinated, were vaccinated twice. Fauci has made similar claims about what's happening in June. All the indications that we have, at least anecdotally, support that that work by the AP. So if you're going to speak in just broad generalities, you're not going to die if you get the vaccine from COVID. Certainly there are some, but to the extent that there are some too, it's a specific cohort, people who are already vulnerable to COVID. We will talk about that later in the program. We're also going to talk about this new law in Texas, 6-week ban on abortion, 6 weeks into a pregnancy. And the innovation here is the way the state is hoping to get away from the question of whether it is constitutional for a state to abridge that right. They have said that the state government cannot enforce this law, that this only creates a civil action. Literally, someone, you could sue someone if you found out that they had an abortion.
You still have to have standing, but I mean,
exactly. Well, aside from standing, you also need to prove damages.
Right.
I mean, and so, but we will get to that. It is in this environment, like to you and I, it seems like a slam dunk. This can't go anywhere, but you're talking about state court judges in Texas, maybe. And you're also talking about a U.S. Supreme Court that is, such questions of consistency are not foregone conclusions when we're talking about this court. But let's get to what else we have today. Here is this is just I don't know, incredibly unhelpful. And I want
to
say
unhelpful to whom though, Sam?
Well, yes. To just about everybody's interests, except for Steve Schmidt.
Let's exactly. Play this clip.
Right. And the Lincoln Project. And by that, I mean, is I take what happened on January 6th very seriously. It is highly problematic. There must be in specific situations, criminal price to pay. But there also needs to be a political price to pay for what took place and who was involved in it. ProPublica has come out with some findings that are very preliminary and reporting that suggest that there was a contact with White House aides between those people who crashed the Capitol and whatnot. I do think there are questions, you know, there are situations where there is hyperbole that is, unhelpful, just broadly speaking. But I think, you know, I don't know that we've crossed that threshold. I think there was unhelpful hyperbole about, what some people call Russiagate, because what happens is it makes it much easier for people to deny some of the realities associated with this. And that hyperbole was both on the on behalf of like people who are promoting sort of wild theories about Russia and Donald Trump, but also on the people who were in complete denial. At one
but
point,
this certainly crosses the threshold of hyperbole. What's
without a doubt, yeah. without a doubt.
Right.
And here is, and that's my point, is this is an example of like, this is destructive in multiple ways to everything except for Steve Schmidt's bank account. Here is Steve Schmidt. Where was this guy? Is this
during a Lincoln Project broadcast.
Yeah. Okay. So Lincoln Project, they're starting their own media company. So here is Steve Schmidt during a Lincoln Project. Remember, this is the guy who was going to hang with Howard Schultz for as long as he'd get paid. And if that meant Howard Schultz was going to run in the general election, this guy was going to make millions. Probably still made well, deep into the six figures. But here we go.
My friend Matthew Dowd, our friend, you know, talked about this. He couldn't be more right. The 1-6 attack for the future of the country is a profoundly more dangerous event than the 9/11 attacks. And in the end, the 1-6 attacks are likely to kill a lot more Americans than were killed on the 9/11 attacks, which will include the casualties of the wars that lasted 20 years following it.
Which wars? Which wars, though, Steve Schmidt? I mean, it's interesting. Well, I mean, it's funny that he decides to talk about war there, given the candidate that he backed in 2008 who supported the Iraq War, given the Republican Party that he was a part of every step of the way that was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, the responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of American troops, and let alone 9/11 itself was more deadly than the January 6th insurrection. I mean, please.
It's just bizarre. I mean, it's a total disregard, of course, for the humanity of all the people that we killed, like you say. I mean, we killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, particularly in Iraq. We also should say, you know, when you talk about the torture regime, you talk about the increased spying on Americans, the spying on Muslims in this country, the increased in just the diminishment of our civil liberties. I mean, we could go on and on. And to say this kind of thing, you know, makes it just sound, it's just a way for him to sell more videos or whatever it is that they're doing over there. It really is pathetic. I mean, there's been so many attempts, and not just on that side. You know, there was I'm reminded of a piece that you know, Matt Taibbi wrote about the whole Russiagate thing, you know, having the same implications, being as being the worst thing that the press had done since, you know, the Iraq War. And I think, you know, I mean, arguably, but the implications, it's the implications are so dramatically different that by, you know, unless you're going to measure some type of very narrow technical definition of those things, the implications of what was done, of what 9/11 led us to do in this country in terms of killing people, and the implications of the media hyping the Iraq War, all of which led to hundreds of thousands of people dying. That's the way you measure implications.
Well, I think the way you measure implications, Sam, is that the implications of 9/11 got Steve Schmidt to get rich, so he doesn't consider them a threat to American democracy. But the implications of January 6th and playing that up as awful as the wake of 9/11, that also gets Steve Schmidt rich. So those are kind of the way we're supposed to measure it, I guess, when analyzing these things.
Whatever makes Steve Schmidt rich could be dangerous for the country, or vice versa.
That's the ballast.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Pascal Robert. He is the co-host of This Is Revolution, contributing writer at Washington Spectator and HuffPost. We'll be back after these words from our sponsor. Ladies and gentlemen, got a couple of sponsors today. I've told this story many times. I'm going to tell it again because it's a great story. A couple of years ago, my sisters and I decided that we wanted to make sure that my mom was eating well. And she's, you know, her cooking, she's not cooking as much. And we wanted to make it easy. We wanted to make it healthy. We wanted to make it tasty. So my sister, to be fair, I don't want to steal any valor. She did a lot of research on this. She's very good about stuff like that. And she decided we're going to send mom freshly. But we knew mom wasn't going to accept chef-made, nutrient-packed, delicious meals delivered directly to her door if she knew that we were paying for it. Because she'd say, like, I can't let you pay for that. And so we told a little white lie. Told my mom that Freshly was advertising with the company, with the show, and they gave me a lifetime free meals. Hint, hint.
Yes.
And and she loved it. She was like, oh, this is so fantastic. Thank you so much. And I'm telling all my friends, I'm so glad they're advertising with you because they're delicious. And my mom's favorite meal was the steak peppercorn.
I love how the lie was based on some like 1970s game show prize, right? Where, you know, you get free meals for life or right, free exactly. chicken for life if you win this, right?
I mean, look, you know, my mom is, I guess she's actually a great generation. Maybe she was a boomer. I'm not sure. But you
right.
know,
you made it contextual.
Yeah. And then coincidentally, I don't know, 6 months ago, Freshly decides to start advertising with us. Very exciting. Freshly, your meals arrive cooked and fresh every week. You can keep your fridge stocked and skip the trip to the store. Ordering is super easy. Freshly.com, you choose from over 30 meals, like my mom's favorite, steak peppercorn. Maybe the least they could do is like name it after my, nah, I don't know, they probably wouldn't do that. Sausage baked penne or their chicken pesto bowl. Freshly can fit your lifestyle with a variety of plans and meals to pick from. They're super flexible, folks. And now, Majority Report listeners can try Freshly for just $6.16 per meal. Your meals are ready to heat and enjoy in just 3 minutes. So right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to Freshly.com/majority. You can stop stressing about dinner. Go to Freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. That's Freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. Also, folks, Emma's favorite sponsor, summer's here. Living is not easy if you get swamp ass. Very hot and wet these days. So,
Jesus Christ.
Yep. but how do you prevent that? Well, refreshing spray from your Hello Tushy bidet. Yep. The brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is here, folks. If you are like me and you have the 2.0, time to upgrade. If you are like many Americans who have yet to realize why the rest of the world is way ahead of us on this, or just like why it's just more hygienic and pleasant, frankly, to use a bidet, then Hello Tushy 3.0 is for you. It doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It also cleans itself with their smart spray automatic nozzle that attaches to your existing toilet. This is one of the two features that I think really surprises people. One, super easy to install. You don't have to, no electricity. You don't have any extra plumbing. It's super easy to install. It cuts toilet paper use by 80%, pays for itself in a few months because it is really, really a reasonably priced. People get intimidated when they hear about bidets. This is, you got to check this out. Hello Tushy has your ass covered also with a 60-day risk-free guarantee, a 12-month warranty. If you're new to the revolution, know that you're joining millions of happy Hello Tushy customers. Defeat swamp ass. Go to hellotushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping. Special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. And lastly, somebody sent me a link to a story in Mass Live at masslive.com. I think that's like what the Globe came through. I don't know. I used to read the sports through there. And it is a story about apparently one of the guys who works at Sunset Lake Sebade, is from Worcester, graduated from Clark, and TJ, he is the one who is like putting stuffing into the boxes of Sebade that you get from Sunset Lake, all of the third party documentation about what's in it. And this story is about Sunset Lake growing in popularity in Massachusetts. They're from Vermont. And they've got that connection to Worcester, TJ and myself, because they've been advertising on this show. TJ was quoted as saying each of these products are supposed to have test results attached to them, but usually you don't find those. Well, with Sunset Lake, they include them and they have them posted on their website. Details the product's exact milligrams inside their packages. And often, like I say, inserted by TJ. He also said, we make sure all our test results are up on the website, very visible. We post our phone number. We have some open social media channels. You can reach out to us on the website with a question to ask us. We want to help. Their products include gummy bears, fudge. This is delicious. Coffee. They have topical lotions and salves. They have smokables. Pre-rolls, what am I, tincture, which helps me sleep, dramatic help in my sleep, all sorts of really wonderful products, and they have all of the documentation up there. They use only organic fertilizers. They are pesticide-free. They use integrated pest management up on this farm, and these guys are our movement partners. They write about this in this piece that Sunset Lake teamed up in part with me to help raise funds and bring attention to striking nurses at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester. And incidentally, they've been on strike now for, I think, close to 120 days, maybe a little bit more. They just met. They were just flew down to Texas because management is negotiating again after trying to hire scabs. They donated $2,500 to those nurses and their movement partners. And according to, and this is the part that I found really gratifying. They were talking about our relationship with them sponsoring the show. And TJ says many of those orders, those initial orders that really helped their business, have turned into repeat customers. Listeners of the show are able to use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, a slogan of the show, to receive 20% off. Repeat customers means that those folks who have ordered really know the quality of this product. So check it out, sunsetlakesibidi.com. All right. Want to welcome back to the program Pascal Robert. He's the co-host of This Is Revolution. He is a contributor to the Black Agenda Report, as well as Washington Spectator and HuffPost. Pascal is joining us right now from, I believe, Florida. Pascal, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again, Sam. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hey, Pascal.
Hey, Emma, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing okay. Is my audio working all right?
Your audio is working great. And wanted to talk to you about a couple of things that are in the news these days. First off, there's been an assassination, obviously, in Haiti.
You heard about that?
I did hear about that. In fact, we reported on the other day. Moise, am I pronouncing his name?
Moise.
Okay.
By the way, Moise is the French name for Moses.
Okay. So Moise was assassinated. Just do us a favor. Will you just go back and give us some very remedial information? Because, you know, people, I think, I mean, I learned this, frankly, from Michael Brooks and the interviews that he did years ago. But prior to that, there was virtually, I never heard any history, not in school, not in the context of why we have had such ongoing involvement in Haiti. Will you talk just briefly about the Haitian independence and the implications that really Haiti has represented for a couple of century and a half, at least, in this country?
So you're asking me to basically sum up 200 plus years of history in a short conversation. I think I can do that.
No pressure.
I knew you could. That's why I asked.
Basically, to understand the situation relative to Haiti is to put Haiti's revolutionary independence struggle that started in 1791 in the context of its proximity to the U.S. history. When the Haitian Revolution started in 1791, George Washington was president of the United States. So we have to understand in relativity to these two factors that the importance of Haiti to the development of the United States in the 19th century and even after its initial founding was very, very important, because prior to Haiti's independence, the Republic was called Saint-Domingue under the auspices and control of the French. The colony was actually more valuable to the French than all 13 colonies were of value to the British, because the trade in sugar, particularly sugar, coffee, tobacco, but particularly sugar and rum, made it one of, if not the most valuable colonies in the slave plantation system that existed in the Western Hemisphere. So one of the things you have to understand as well is that, contrary to in the consciousness of a lot of people who look at slavery in the American context as being so brutal, so horrible, the French plantation system in Haiti was absolutely egregious. If any of you, I'm sure you guys have read Black Jacobins, which is a book I have some issues with for various problems. They used to do things like bury slaves in sand and put molasses on their head and have maggots and ants eat at their face. They would put gunpowder in the anal orifices of Africans who were rebellious to literally have them explode. The type of tortures that the French would engage in with the Africans on the plantation was absolutely brutal beyond words, so much so that the average life expectancy of an African slave who was brought to the island as a young adult or an adult would be no more than 5 to 7 years. So in other words, you bring an 18-year-old African slave to Haiti, at best, he's going to live to maybe, 25, 26, and he's going to die. And one of the reasons why the French did not care about that is, if you read actually French writings, they would say things like, the shores of Africa are always generous. They basically believed that they could just keep coming in and importing and importing and importing more and more Africans. And if they died like flies, it didn't make a difference. That was fine. So much so that several of the other colonies, because of the rebellious nature of these Africans on these plantations, were a little bit leery of importing such large numbers, which did affect some of the United States at a certain point in terms of its attitude towards importing Africans. So what basically happens is that in 1791, a group of mostly African slaves have a ceremony that is known by Haitian ceremony Bwakaima, where they basically created a united front religiously. Some of them were animists or voodooists, some of them were Muslim, and they basically came together and decided to unify their various religious diversity that they would have had on the African continent in a kind of spiritual pact to join together to fight the French plantation owners. So they started, after they had that ceremony, a week later, they started savagely just burning and killing European plantation or French plantation owners by the hundreds. They killed like a couple of thousand within a week. So this violence starts to expand and expand and expand. And it's basically just guerrilla warfare. And what happens is that because the island was so valuable, the French have competitors in this exploit. Don't forget, the other half of the island, which is now the Dominican Republic, is controlled by the Spanish. The Spanish, seeing that the French are basically going through chaos, and this is also proximate to the French Revolution, are saying, yo, listen, we can come in here and we can actually say we're going to promise these Africans that we're going to free them, and we can fight the French, get them out of here, and we can like free some of them and actually still have some slavery for others who are lower class. And, you know, this can work out for us. So what happens is the Spaniards come into the island and they actually start to train some of the more high level slaves like Toussaint Louverture and others as soldiers officially in the Spanish army to fight against the French to maintain control of the island, because the Spanish are like, this is a lot of money here, man. We're gonna keep this. And what happens is that, now understand something, even though the French were brutal plantation owners, all of the Africans, the blacks, and the you know, mulattoes, what you would call biracials, were more culturally in affinity to the French. They spoke Creole or French. Their culture was, even though there was obviously an African dominant culture amongst the slaves, they had a more cultural affinity to the French. So when the French are realizing that the Spaniards are here helping the Africans to defeat them, so they're going to lose this island, they're like, we can't afford to lose this place. This is too expensive. This is too valuable. The French come in and say, listen, for you Africans, we will free you if you agree to help us fight the Spanish and get them out of here. So the Africans were like, oh, great, we can be French now. This is awesome. And they basically, this is under Toussaint Louverture, they're like, okay, we'll now fight for the French. We'll turn our back on the Spaniards and we will fight and kick the Spaniards out. The Africans, under the guise of the French, fight the Spaniards, boom, they kick the Spaniards out. So now the Africans are like, oh, great, okay, now the French are going to, you know, basically treat us fair, everything's gonna be great. Well, guess what happens in the room? The British, who are like, all right, those Spanish are nothing, but the French are still weak. We want to come in and put these Africans back in shackles because we hate these French and we can take the whole island. You know, we can make it ours. So the British come in, they send their biggest export of ships. They send like 50,000 troops to the island, and they're like, We're gonna wax these Negroes, and we're gonna take this place, and we're gonna have it for ourselves, and the French will be done. They came to the island. 10,000 British soldiers died in 2 months.
Wow!
That's slaughtered. This was under Toussaint Louverture. As a matter of fact, if you read a book, there's a book called by a guy named David Geggis, and there was a story in newspapers in London. It was said that the British losses in the Haitian Revolution were so bad that there was not a single British person who didn't have someone in their family who experienced a loss in the Haitian campaigns. So, okay. The British take off. The Spanish are out. Bang. The British are out. Bang. So now the French are like, okay, Toussaint Louverture is governor general of the island. He's running the island. And they say, okay, listen, you can free the Creole black. This is very important. This is something that's very important, crucial detail that many people don't understand about the Haitian Revolution. There are three classes of black people in Haiti. One is pejoratively called the Bosal. You'd probably spell that B-O-S-S-A-L. The Bosal were Africans that were born in Africa that were transplanted to the island. So in other words, they obviously would be a little bit more rebellious, less acculturated to French culture, and they would be used to being free. The next are the Creole blacks. Creole blacks are blacks who were born on the island but were not born in Africa. So they were more acculturated to the French system. They spoke better French. They had higher class standing than the Bosal Africans, but they were still blacks. Some of them were slaves. Some of them were free. And the blacks who were free sometimes owned slaves. Guess what? Toussaint Louverture, before the Haitian Revolution, actually owned black slaves. It shocks a lot of people. And then you had the Creoles, who were mulatto, who were biracial or biracial adjacent in their opinions, who were also often free, but, you know, hated the blacks, wanted to be French, and owned 25% of the black slaves. So not only do you have white people owning slaves in Saint-Domingue, pre-revolutionary Haiti, you have Creole blacks, and you have Creole mulattoes who own slaves, a lot of them as well. This causes a situation where the blacks, the Creole blacks, kind of hate the mulattoes because they think they're better than them because their skin is light and they're more white, so they hate each other. The Creole mulattoes hate the Creole blacks, even though they're close in class standing because they're black and they're like, they don't want to be black. And the African Bosal hate them both because they oppress both of them. And the Creole blacks and mulattoes hate the Bosal because they're the lower rung on the totem pole and they're considered, you know, savages, Africans, so on and so forth. This class division plagues Haitian society to this day.
So, I want to return to that a little bit. I mean, in terms of like what were those factors? Well, I guess maybe now is the best time to address that part of it. Are those factors just driven? I mean, by both just race and culture? I mean, were they in
race, class, culture, capital, status? You know, all of those things, all of those great things that dialectical materialists tell you to study if you study some Marx.
Right. All right. And so when,
by the way, the best part is, this is a good part, because we got out, they kicked out the British, they kicked out the French, they kicked out the Spanish. You're like, well, what happens with the French? What happens is with the French is that Napoleon takes power in France, right? And Napoleon is like, I have no tolerance for any of these Negroes. I want all these guys with their epaulets on their shoulders to be ripped off, put them all in shackles or exterminate them. I want them gone. I don't want to hear anything about no Toussaint Louverture running anything or any Negroes owning slaves. So Napoleon sends, you know, squadrons, dragoons of squadrons to the island to basically shut this whole game down. Toussaint Louverture is kind of like worried about, oh, the French are coming. Don't forget, Toussaint Louverture up in this time never fought the French army with his own body. He fought the English and he fought the Spanish, but he had not fought the French. Well, Toussaint is a little kind of hesitant back and forth, and his second in command, Dessalines, is like, listen, man, we got to take it to these French because, you know, this is not going to be a good thing. Toussaint Louverture is eventually captured by the French, sent back to France, put in a prison, and dies begging Napoleon to be sent back to Haiti to be his governor general again. Napoleon Bonaparte dies saying his biggest mistake was not allowing Toussaint Louverture to come back. Dessalines, who hated the French, despised them, because there's another little class division between Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines. Toussaint Louverture is what you call an ancien libre or an old freed. What does that mean? When the Haitian Revolution starts in 1791, Toussaint Louverture had been a free man of color for about 20 years. So he knew freedom. He owned slaves. He owned property. Dessalines, though he was a Creole like Toussaint Louverture, was a nouveau libre. He was newly freed because of the revolution that started in 1791, and he was a brutally beat slave until 1791. So he had, even though he was not a Bosal or an African brought to the island, he had approximate identification with them because he was just as brutally treated, even though he was a Creole, but he was only freed by the happenstance of the beginning of the Haitian Revolution. So there was a major divergent class worldview amongst these two men who were both Black, who were both born on the island, but because of the difference in times in which they were freed proximate to the beginning of the revolution and their relationship with the French and the empires that they fought with, they had two totally different worldviews of both French, Europeans, and white people.
And relative to the United States, and basically, I want to just bring this back to a comment that Brian Concannon, who I think you know, was talking about the other day on the program, was as to why the United States has been consistently intervening and manipulating Haiti. I mean, in terms of like sheer dollars, Concannon was like, it's not necessarily, he doesn't think it's just necessarily resources. It's about the potential for Haiti to provide a model.
Yeah, it's the fear it's the fear of a positive model.
And indeed, that was the concern, the American concern with the Haitian Revolution, was that this is going to provide some type of paradigm or blueprint or model or inspiration for American slaves.
For Black liberation.
And Black liberation in the United States.
Right.
That's correct. Not only that, well, let me get finished to how this, what happens is that Toussaint Louverture goes, dies in the jail. Dessalines takes over the soldiers, the Haitian soldiers. Toussaint Louverture's capture inspires them to get more aggressive. Dessalines, who was rather brutal himself, says, we're going to massacre these French. And he totally defeats the French army. They are completely defeated, and they go back in shame, and they surrender to the country in a battle called Vertier that happens in November of 1803. And in the January of 1804, the next year, Dessalines, as the president and leader of the country, declares Haiti, and he changes the name from Saint-Domingue back to this original Arawak name and calls it Haiti, which the long name is Haiti Kesquia Bohio, which is Haiti, the lands of mountains and valleys. But the thing that's interesting, as antagonistic as the United States has been to the Haitian Revolution and the Haitian people, there is no country that has been a bigger beneficiary of the Haitian Revolution than the United States. Because you know what happened and allowed the United States to receive as a result of the Haitian Revolution?
The slave trade bigger there.
No. The Louisiana Territory.
Right.
Why? Because Napoleon had sent 25,000 troops, which was actually larger than the U.S. Army, to New Orleans before he came to Haiti with a plan. He sent some troops to Haiti and some to New Orleans. His plan was like, after I beat these Africans in Haiti, I'm going to go to New Orleans and I'm going to conquer North America and I'm going to make all these Yankees my French colonies. That was the plan. Because the Haitians were beating him so bad, he had to change the plan, take the army that he had in New Orleans, send them to Haiti, and they got waxed as well. And his plan to actually take over North America was vanquished. And because he got beat so bad to finance his losses, he sold all of the Louisiana Territory, which doubled the size of the United States, to Thomas Jefferson for less than 8 cents an acre. Which made the United States the country that it is to this day. Not only do we the United States get the land that made the country, Haiti literally protected the United States from becoming a French colony.
All right. So that was pretty comprehensive wrap up of history in a relatively short period of time. So let's go to present day. I mean, if we know that the U.S. foreign policy establishment has viewed Haiti as a threat insofar as it could provide a model for the rest of you know, Latin America, Central America, it could just simply
provide global South, the black world, the colonized world.
Exactly. And so give us a sense of like what your sense is of what happened. I mean, in terms of this assassination, let's take it to present day.
Oh, well, first of all, what happens in the 20th century is the United States occupies Haiti from 1915 to 1934, to literally takes all the gold out of the Haitian coffers, sends it to Citibank, violently and brutally abuses the Haitian people. It controls the economy there for almost like 20 some odd years. And Haiti basically since 1984 has never had any real sovereignty over its government. Any president that was president of Haiti, if he even altered or deviated from the United States agenda, was either given a coup like Estime was in 1850 or possibly threatened with assassination. And if he wasn't, he was a complete tool and puppet of the United States, like Papa Doc was, Francois Duhayer. Why was Papa Doc such a valuable tool? Because he was anti-communist in the age of Fidel Castro. And so he was perfect. Use your charade of black nationalism to be anti-communist and the U.S. will support you. We got no problems. Just make sure you don't have any Haitian commies like my uncles in your country and get rid of them. Okay, so the Duvalier regime is very valuable. Guess why the Duvalier regime is kicked out in 86? Because what's happening in 86? The Soviet Union is falling apart. The fear of communism is no longer. We don't need the Duvalier regime anymore. Goodbye, get out.
And so, so take us up to today.
So what happens today? The next regime that was actually the first democratically elected regime, which was somewhat radical because it was actually caring about poor people, was Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was a priest who was into liberation theology. I think that's the best thing, closest thing you can get to Marxism as a Catholic. And he wanted to do massive wealth transformation, increase the minimum wage, and do something for the Haitian poor, who were the descendants of those African Bosals that both the Creole blacks and mulattoes looked down on and frankly didn't care about, and who made up the supermajority of Haitians and the majority of the Haitians who are poor. And he realized that this class setup is horrible, and there's a Haitian oligarchy, which is made up of people who aren't even organically Haitian. Most of them are Syrian, Lebanese, Arabs, Europeans who came to Haiti in the early 20th century, started businesses, and started getting major business concessions under the U.S. occupation and during the presidency of Duvalier, because they supported Duvalier against the mulattoes who Duvalier hated, or the biracial or the fair complexion Haitians. And they control literally 90% of the economy in Haiti today. That's a very important factor. The Haitian oligarchy becomes a proxy for the State Department in Haiti, in that whenever a coup is needed in Haiti, it's usually organized and orchestrated by the Haitian oligarchy with the support of the U.S. State Department. We have emails of one of the Haitian oligarchs going back and forth with Clinton aides, planning elections and things of that nature. So they are what Franz Fanon would call the neocolonial bourgeoisie in Haiti. But they're not Haitian, and they actually don't even look black. They actually look like Arabs, Syrians, and Europeans.
But Moïse was definitely in that tradition, right? I mean, he was
It's a little complicated, right?
Right.
PHTK, which was his party, which is the Parti Tetkale, which is the ball. They call it the ballhead party because Michel Martelly, who was a pawn of the U.S., who was put in to govern over the earthquake so the Clintons could extract as much money as they could after the earthquake rebuilding, started a party called PHTK. He was president during the Haiti earthquake rebuilding, did minor rebuilding of the country, did some things that he could. But what happened is during the rebuilding, in 2010, we had the Haiti earthquake, massive devastation. We all know about it. Massive amounts of international money are flowing into the country for development, right? Cash is everywhere, even though none of it is going to the Haitian poor.
Right.
What this exposes to people like Martelly is that we don't have to be dependent on the Haitian oligarchy because they always extort money from the government because they're parasites. We can actually deal with international actors, get development deals done, like building roads and hospitals, for a cheaper price than the oligarchies, even though it's still under neoliberalism. Because these oligarchs are such crooks, we can actually cut better deals with international actors than the oligarchs. That's when that seed is first planted in the head of the PHTK party, that we can cut the oligarchs out and deal with international actors. Martelly's term is up, and he hand taps a guy who comes from the peasant lower classes. No one knew who this guy was. His name was Jovenel Moïse, and they basically say, this is going to be my replacement. The U.S. okays an election, which was totally fraudulent and totally illegitimate. Moïse becomes president. Because the country is forced into austerity because of a certain oil relationship with Venezuela that goes bad through the quote-unquote Petro-Caribe economic consignment that Venezuela gave to Haiti and Haitian oil. Because oil prices go up and Venezuelan oil can't be used anymore, the IMF puts sanctions on, tells Haiti, you guys got to double your oil prices. And that's the beginning of the problems for Moïse. And the country basically goes into austerity. Much of the reason why Moïse has such a crappy administration is because the loss of the Venezuelan concessions forces energy prices to be so high in Haiti that the country is forced into austerity. He has to cut services, and poor people are suffering, and they're pissed, and they're trying to rebel. They're like, yo, you're not helping us out here. At the same time, because Moïse is under that PHTK plan of cutting out the oligarchs, when he gets into the administration, he's given 4 contracts, like 25-year contracts, that's supposed to go to the oligarchs. One is to control all the ports, which means you control all the trade. One is to control who imports the oil. One is to control who controls the electricity for like 25 years. And I think another one is who develops the roads in the country. All of these contracts are exploitative as hell. They would cost like twice as much as if the state did the planning itself. But because the oligarchs have such a parasitic control of the country, they were given these contracts by the prior prime minister, I think a guy named Juscelin Prévert, before Jovenel Moïse becomes president. Even though Jovenel Moïse was initially supported by one of the major oligarch families, at a certain point in line with the PHTK, PHTK is a kind of neo-devaluerist party in which they believe that they're going to bring back the renaissance of a black political class in Haiti to displace the kind of the oligarchs who both even the mulatto and the black middle class kind of despise. All right. They've actually become, the oligarchs became the top of the food chain. They displaced even the mulatto or fair complexion Haitians and even the black elites, and they were at the top of the food chain, and both those middle class Haitians despised them. So there was a belief that PHTK was going to be a revival of this kind of like duvalierist kind of like multicolored middle class kind of shtick. I didn't buy it. I thought they were ultimately neoliberal anyway. But the larger point is that Moïse under the plan of like, okay, let's try to find a way to undercut the oligarchs. He decides at a certain point in his administration to throw those contracts in the trash. And that's when the real beef between him and certain factions of the oligarchy start getting hot. They start financing gangs. He starts financing his own reprisals. Poor people are dying left and right. He's having some of the oligarchs' businesses burnt up and destroyed. And there's basically an internal war going on between Moise and the oligarchs, but because Moise is okay in the eyes of the U.S., why? Because Moise stabbed Venezuela in the back after those oil concessions and said, I don't support Nicolas Maduro, and I support Juan Guaido, so I have no problem with Guaido, and whatever the U.S. says is fine. He aligns himself with Trump. He's Trump's boy. Because Biden still hates Venezuela and has no problem with Moise's stabbing Venezuela in the back, Biden decides, okay, he can be our boy too. He's not a problem. Okay, we don't care what he's doing with the oligarchs as long as he helps us squash Venezuela. So he was valuable to the U.S. because he was a bulwark against the pink tide in South America and Latin America. What happens is that the beef between the oligarchs and Moise gets so hot because Moise is signing contracts. I posted a post on my Twitter. His last trip, he did a trip last month when he went to Turkey. And he had memorandums of understanding with the Turkish government to do development deals in Haiti. So not only did he throw out the contracts that the oligarchy was promised, he's cutting major deals to have all of the tasks that they were going to do done by international actors. Okay, so this all comes to a head, and someone has him whacked. If you ask me who I did it, I think it was done by the oligarchy with the green light of the United States, because I think the United States said, listen, this guy's too much of a problem. There's too much chaos. If you guys can guarantee a transition to a new administration that's friendly to both the United States and you guys, the oligarchs, since the oligarchs are always in the State Department's pocket, you guys can go with it. That's my theory.
That sounds pretty strong. I mean, there's a quality. It sounds like when it's a question of Moise and or the oligarchs, it's the United States sort of feels like heads we win, tails we also win, because we've got Coke and Pepsi fighting it out, and at the end of the day, we're still going to have our cola, I guess. And the idea at that point, we just apparently. Jen Psaki has said that the Biden administration calls for free and fair elections in Haiti and stands ready to receive a formal request for assistance if it comes.
Oh, so there you go. Now we're going to have the U.S. talking about we're going to come on down. That's the last thing they need. He's ready to rock and roll. It's going to be Clinton Obama 2.0.
So do you anticipate, I mean, who is there, as you look at the landscape in Haiti right now, is there an opportunity for who do you perceive, if anybody, within the government or within Haitian society, who represents a possibility for an actual sort of like advancement of democracy?
I think, listen, I had Daoud André, who's a very well-known Haitian radical activist from Brooklyn, on our show, and he said there is no one who is trustworthy in Haitian civil society. The only thing that can save this country is Haitian Revolution 2.0.
And what would that look like at that point? Like,
what would look like major, 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 major attacks on the oligarchs, because they're the tip of the problem, and a decision by the black middle class and fair complexion middle class with as to who they're going to align with. Because don't forget, those middle class blacks and fair complexion mulattoes, they usually work for the oligarchs in their jobs.
Yeah,
they own the banks. They own all the institutions.
And so, in other
words, part of the problem is that this class,
they've been co-opted,
scheme,
yeah,
which is destroying the lives of 75% of the country, is supported by middle class Haitians like my own family.
Well, it's a bit of musical chairs, right? Because, yeah, even if Moise, he kind of became so problematic that he was the odd man out and the oligarchs teamed up against him. I mean, he was incredibly wealthy, right? Made his fortune.
He had some corrupt. He was not like oligarch wealthy. He had some change.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, then revolution, how does that come to be? What kind of organizing effort?
Well, that's a good question.
Right. Yeah. Know? Right.
Yeah. The United States does not want that.
In regards to the Haitian middle class, who provides sort of the ballast, right? I mean, that is that they I mean, it sounds like you perceive the Haitian middle class as being the almost like the fulcrum of this situation.
Don't forget, a lot of the diaspora makes up the Haitian middle class, even in absentia.
And where? What about the Haitian diaspora? I mean, we have.
I wouldn't trust them to. I wouldn't trust them to throw a tannin because a lot of them supported the coup to get rid of Aristide, and many of them just want to go back to Haiti and live bougie middle class lives with Restavec peasant, you know, servants that they can, you know, hang out with and sexually molest when they get a chance.
Oof. All right. You don't perceive that there is an opportunity.
I think that there's some of them that can be. I think that the hope for the country is actually in the younger diaspora, not my parents' generation. They're hopeless. The younger Haitian diaspora who's living in America realizes that all this class nonsense is idiocy. If they could really get an educational terrain and understanding the what's going on in the ground, they're old enough to have resources and education. I think there's a potential if they nullify the oligarchy, people who are like, I would say, 60 and younger or 50 and younger, I think that they could actually transform the country, but it could not be under a neoliberal capitalist paradigm.
Let me just ask you this too. To what extent does the cohort of Haitians who are here under temporary protected status, and they've been sort of like, they were like a football, I guess, in the context of like the end of the Trump administration, where do they stand? Like, I mean,
are people who are usually poor from the peasant class who are just, you know, they're fleeing their country. So they're refugees. They're coming to America trying to make a better life for themselves. So they're typically trying to bounce between not getting caught out there by ICE and trying to, like, you know, find some kind of menial job. They don't have really a say because they can't vote. They're not U.S. citizens. They can't lobby the government. But we have a Haitian misleadership class as well, with journalists at certain publications, Miami Herald and otherwise, Haitian elected officials who do the same, you know, buck dancing, worthless dance that the black misleadership class does to the Democratic Party that usually works to the detriment of the Haitian people. So unfortunately, we are mimicking that charade within our own community.
And there's no power center in the context of this country. There's certainly no political party that is going to change.
No, because the Democrats have actually been more toxic in the relationship to Haiti than the Republicans in the last 20 years. Except for Bush, the father, because the Bushes did the Aristide coup. So I got to make that one alteration.
I know you just really. I know you talked about the Clintons just in terms of the historical progression of Haiti, but also can you expand on what happened in the wake of the earthquake and how, via the Clinton Foundation, outside of power, really there simple. Was a the, neoliberal the, project.
The Clintons use Haiti as their personal ATM machine.
Right.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, just go into that a little bit because I don't know if people fully appreciate that.
Well, Hillary Clinton's brother who died had literal contracts with gold mining in Haiti. There was gold discovered in Haiti. He had personal contracts for gold mining concessions.
Which gives you a sense of, one would imagine that's probably a function of her role in the U.S. government as opposed to Rodham, I think is his name, was his. All right. Well, and so what do you anticipate? Like, what do you anticipate happening? I mean, it's sort of like a bleak sort of near term forecast.
Welcome to Haitian life.
There you go. How do you anticipate this going down? Like, what is there?
I think the U.S. is going to send a UN probably contingency like MINUSTAH that we had during the earthquake and after Aristide. That was horrendous, who brought cholera to the country because they literally poured feces into the Artibonite River and gave cholera to the Haitian people. It's either going to be a UN military kind of MINUSTAH-like embarkment, or it'll be the U.S., which will be a nightmare because I think even America, I don't think the Biden administration wants to take that on at this time,
right?
Because that's just too much of an 800-pound gorilla in an era where, you know, listen, don't forget, Trump appealed to the Haitians against Hillary Clinton. He came to little Haiti in Miami and said, they've done you wrong, I'll do you right. We could take a look at the number of Haitians that voted for Trump in 2016 and ask if they flipped the state in Florida.
Wow. We're and so Biden certainly. I mean, I think the Biden administration wants to have as little, you know, sort of anything but, you know, three alarm fire in terms of their foreign policy. I think that's what they're not interested in engaging. You know, it's like the same thing with Israel and Palestine. They have no interest. To the extent that they can in engaging in any of this. I think they'd be happy to maintain the status quo. So I would imagine.
Right, they're going to maintain the status quo. The question is, can they orchestrate a sham election effective enough to put in a puppet that will do the bidding of both the oligarchs and the Biden administration?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean.
Without the Haitian grassroots totally just setting the country on fire.
I guess we will see. And my guess is if they don't find that person, then we'll just get another round of this type of violence.
Or there's revolution, which is, you know, your calls for that. It fits nicely to the podcast. Plug of your podcast. Yeah. Right, exactly.
Revolution podcast. Check it out at your relevant social media on YouTube, Tuesday nights, 9 p.m., Thursday night, 9 p.m. Also on Saturdays at noon. Also your relevant podcast apps, Apple Podcasts. This is Revolution Podcast with my great co-host, Jason Miles.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that. Well, we only have about 2.5 minutes left, and I wanted to get your take on Eric Adams as a former Queens native.
Make a Queens, baby.
But we only have about 2 minutes left. So I'm not sure that we have time to go into that. But
well, you're the one who asked me for 200 years of Haitian history, man. I mean,
I know. I'm glad I did, frankly. we'll have more time to talk about Eric Adams. He will not win the general election, I guess, until November anyways. So maybe we'll have you back on for a bite at that apple. Pascal Robert, the podcast is This is Revolution Podcast. And we will put a link to that at majority.fm and in all our descriptions. Thank you so much.
By the way, tonight we're having a show on Haiti with Dr. Paul McComb on This is Revolution.
All right, great. Folks, just check that out. And now I feel like folks have at least a context and a basis to understand what's going on down there right now. I appreciate that. Thanks so much for coming on.
All right.
Thanks, Pascal. Right.
No we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to wrap it up in a moment. Well, I wanted to get into Eric Adams a little bit in New York. We will have time to pick that up in the future. But specifically, New York is being used by members of the Democratic establishment to attack the progressives and the left flank in the Democratic Party and their calls for, you know, Medicare for all. And then also, by extension, folks who were engaged in the protests in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests, in the wake of the Floyd killing, and the calls to defund the police and whatnot. And we have a great clip.
We talked about it for like 20 minutes yesterday with David Friedlander. So if people want to check that out, it was on yesterday's show, a little bit about Eric Adams.
Great. And take that out and check that out. Mehdi Hassan had a great exchange with Clyburn to sort of illustrate that dynamic where you still have these establishment Democrats who are attempting to frame the last of the underperformance or the perceived underperformance by Democrats as a function of defund the police or Medicare for all. We know that the data shows that there really wasn't that much of an underperformance of Democrats in the House. They basically aligned with Joe Biden's performance. But we will talk more about that going forward in the future. If you're watching us on Peacock, we will say adieu and have a great weekend. And
yes,
we will see you on Monday. If you are not watching us on Peacock, then hello.
Hi, hello again.
How are you? Aaron is not cool, just IM'd us and said, wanted to hear the crew's initial takes on the executive orders Biden announced today. We're going to do that in the fun half. We're doing like a shorter Friday show for the freebies because we did a freebie the other day. Oh, we didn't do that, did we? I thought that I've been working under the misapprehension that whole thing with your own Brooke.
No, it just felt like it.
I thought that was part of, so there was a lot of people who didn't hear that.
Well, I mean, it's clipped for the YouTube channel, so.
Oh, we did clip it for the YouTube. All right, folks. Well, you can check that out, that debate. Boy, it didn't. People really took issue with your own basically saying that, you know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
Yeah.
The idea that, like, you need to be responsible for the structural integrity of any building that you live in. And, of course, the engineering requirements, knowing the calculations on.
Well, that's not entirely true, Sam. You should check out Papa the Band's IM I'm about to send.
Papa the Band IM?
Yes, essentially, though, it is helpful to basically have people who live in buildings who aren't up on the structural integrity of their buildings and don't do it. I mean, if they die, then it's just the weak being weeded out, obviously. I mean, that's the natural extension of Yaron's argument.
I mean, what would Yaron think about 9/11, for instance? Should people like have an understanding of the terrorism, the terror experts?
Yeah.
Hey, if you knew enough about the integrity of steel, I mean, let's not get into that part, but let's put up that tweet, Brendan. I'll read that off because it's a pretty good one. And this is, look, folks, you got a lot of young people out there. You need to understand what you're up against when you go out into the world. And this is a good summation. Thanks to the debate, I am now a libertarian, says Pop of the Band. I am boning up on my understanding of electrical and plumbing codes, learning about building integrity, looking into my doctor, looking into the numbers that make me think my doctor is a good doctor, looking into who is behind every study about medicine and every medical decision this doctor is going to help me make. Also became a mechanic so I can buy a car without the safety of a lemon law. Dude, libertarianism is great. Papa, you are shirking some of your responsibilities in terms of finding out the some of hiring a food inspector for your food supply, and of course checking that your water is safe for you to drink, and that
has he looked into the background of us on the show, our funding? Has he done any research about Sam's long history of organized crime? There are a lot of things that
you didn't have to bring that part up, but okay.
Well, I'm trying to shield myself from liability, deflect, so yes, nobody looks into that attempted murder charge on my record.
So anyways, kids, if you're headed out to heading out to the real world, I guess we could say this for, you know, recent graduates, bone up. So you get a lot of stuff you got to know to really be doing adulting, as we say. Folks, it is.
We do what?
Adulting?
We do say that.
We do say adulting. Yeah, of course.
No. Yeah.
Folks, you can support this show by becoming a member at Join the Majority Report. Here's the other thing. This is from a couple of days ago. Black tank top shirts, $79.
Oh,
white
my God.
Tank top shirts, $21.
So what's 79 plus 21?
100. I am assuming that there has been one other sale of the tank tops. So in the coming weeks, probably on Friday, after the first hour, sun's out, guns out, Watch out. Watch out, everybody.
You could have did that at the Upstate studio.
I do that down here.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm going to do it in Brooklyn. Are you kidding? Yeah. Sun's out, guns out. It's people are going to have to wear sunglasses in the studio.
I'm down for that, but it's going to be more than sunglasses. You're going to, right. Okay. I hope you're using your native deodorant when you bring your guns out.
Of course. Of course. But there it is, folks. Challenge met. I got to tell you, I don't think I've ever worn a tank top in my entire life.
I'll wear the tank top too. I don't care about that.
I just never have. I mean, I'm not, I don't know why. Like I just never have.
Are you wearing the tank top from the store?
Yeah, I'm going to wear the...
I'll do it too.
All right. We got I think, two right in the office.
Well, I just want to do it too so people can compare how bad you look to how good I'll look in the tank top.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to be helpful to me. But be that as it may, ladies and gentlemen, it's a reminder, shop.majorityreportradio.com to get all of the merch. We still have, I think, a limited number of the Oh No, It's Sam Cedar, What a Effing Nightmare t-shirt that is also for sale there. Baseball shirts also. I should have made it like if we sell 100 baseball shirts, I'll wear one of the baseball shirts. Baseball shirts I feel comfortable in. Tank top, I'm not, I don't think I've honestly ever worn a tank top in my entire life. Certainly not. Other than a sketch or something.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, did you guys wear it for Ken, Ken, and Ken?
For Ken, Ken, and Ken, I would roll up the sleeves, but it wasn't a full-on tank top. So okay. People have never seen it before. Nobody. I don't think even my family members. Folks, don't forget, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, support the show, and you get extra content every single freaking day. Don't forget. Know Me Show, Tuesdays and Thursdays. Check it out at youtube.com/TheKnowMcKee Show. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian universe?
Yeah, on a Wednesday, which is the new night for Left Reckoning, we had Austin Gonzalez of Machete y Mate on to talk about international trips he took to Peru and Venezuela with DSA. So that was a really interesting episode. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We've got a bonus coming out soon for those people. So if you want to get access to that in the post game, so patreon.com/LeftReckoning or subscribe to the YouTube.
Also we have I guess we won't introduce them today. We'll do it next week, but, we'll talk about that next week. I don't want to go into that right now. Cause we got to say goodbye to somebody. We got to say hello to somebody, but maybe it's too early to do that. Folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, back, back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A
hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.